I don't want to gloss over that point. You literally feel like you're coming out all of the time. And it was acute when I had my son. We have a 12-year-old and a 6-year-old. I was in the office and pregnant, obviously. And I would just get asked wildly inappropriate questions. I mean, things that people just shouldn't be asking anybody really about their pregnancy journey. And I would get asked them, I think, because it was a curiosity and, you know, probably a little bit of sport as well. And so I don't want to pretend like those things weren't hard, but there was a meeting that I was in that made it clear to me that it was time for me to sort of stop navigating everybody else's comfort and prioritize mine. I was in a room of SVPs and somebody asked me a question. They said, "How did you get pregnant?" And it was much more crass than that. I'm making this a little bit nicer for your podcast. And so I looked at them and I said, essentially the idea was, did you bring a man home so that you could get pregnant, knowing full well that I was married, right, to a woman? And clearly, you know, maybe that wasn't the process. Maybe it is for somebody else, but either way, not an appropriate question to ask in a mixed audience. And I found myself looking back at the person very calmly and saying, "I know more about the sperm that created this baby than your wife probably knows about yours. Next question." And it never came up again. And there were younger women in that room that I think needed to see somebody really stand up to somebody asking a question that was so out of bounds.
I'm Ethan Devitt, and welcome to this 50 Faces Focus series, in which we are celebrating LGBTQ+ professionals in a special series for Pride Month 2023. I'm joined today by Maggie Lauer, who describes herself as a pop culture enthusiast and music lover, as well as a CMO and board member. She was formerly CMO for Hootsuite, a social media management platform, where she fostered a collaborative marketing approach. She joined the board of directors of Grindr, the largest LGBTQIA+ social networking app, and has won multiple awards as an LGBTQIA+ advocate and has also been a keynote speaker. She holds multiple roles as a senior board advisor. Welcome, Maggie. Thanks for joining me today.
Thank you for having me. I'm excited to talk with you.
Well, let's start by looking at your background. Can you tell us about your background, where you grew up, and what your early interests were?
Sure. I'll make the early part quick because I was born in Chicago, but we moved to St. Louis when I was in fourth grade. So I think if you combined my years in Chicago, I should definitely claim Chicago as home, but there's something about spending your formative years somewhere that makes it feel like home. So I would say the early part of my life was very focused on sports, frankly. I was really, really into team sports and athletics. I had the kind of father that came home every day and we would wait for him on the couch until he got home and we'd give him enough time to take his suit jacket off and we would go into the yard and play until the sun went down. So that was a big influence just in how I think about life in general. And it's always been team sports. I didn't play a lot of individual sports. It was basketball and volleyball and softball. So that's been a big influence in how I think about my career as well. I've always gravitated to leaders that were compelling to me that I thought would invest in me the same way a coach would if I did the work. And so my early career journey, it looks sort of non-traditional because it is. I would follow, you know, like actors follow directors, I would follow leaders that I really admired. And so if I thought I could learn something, if I thought that it would add something to my toolkit, that was really what made the determining factor for me in how I would choose my next role. So I was in banking for 13 years, started in, you know, the trust company world, trust and estate planning, and then worked in 4 different divisions of Bank of America. And one of the wonderful things about working for a large billion-dollar organization is that there's always work. There's always interesting things to do. So really made my name there as a what we would call like a corporate athlete or a change agent. So I would go into things that were burning or that really needed an overhaul. And my job was to come in and transform them. And so towards the end of that, you start moving into these progressive increase in leadership responsibilities. And so by the end, I was working for a managing director who managed a large book of business and was really working in the institutional space. So institutional investing, and found a home there where I could really explore all the different areas of the corporate function. So I had a piece of marketing, I had tech, I had the tech budget, I had the finance budget, I had the HR budget. So I really functioned as his number two. And Paul was one of those really formative mentors, as was one that I'll talk about a little bit later, who just saw something in me probably before I saw it. I think that's something that really defines the difference between a mentor and a sponsor, which is something that I talk about a lot. And so, you know, those years parlayed into, there was an executive that left Bank of America who really felt like, coming out of my graduate degree, I got a degree from Kellogg and I was going to school full-time and working full-time. And what she really needed was an executive to come in and transform a function at Aon Hewitt. And so I had my first CMO role there 12 years ago now. And so from there, I've had these really interesting opportunities to work in different industries. Marketing is a super portable skill set, it turns out, which allows you to learn so much more about how the world makes money and how the world services its communities. So I've worked in healthcare with Ann Hewitt. We did a spin out. Blackstone purchased a portion of Aon Hewitt, the outsourcing business, and that was sold to Blackstone. I worked on the naming of that company and the launch of that company into the public space. From there, I moved into global staffing and recruiting at TrueBlue, which is a holding company brand, and with the responsibility there to digitize the labor economy, get shifts and work, you know, sort of paired through an app. And so from there, I've worked in PR, I've worked in social media management, and it's just been a really wonderful ride. And I would attribute those early years at Bank of America being exposed to so many different things, which to my effectiveness as a B2B marketer, because I do think in B2B marketing, really understanding the language of business is how you get investment in marketing. It's quite a different space than B2C, I would say.
Well, so much there. I love, first of all, your comparison to, you know, actors and directors and to following bosses or coach-like sponsors or mentors within a workplace, something that we haven't developed enough. And it's actually, I think your reference back to sport is something that comes up time and time again in these podcasts, because we hear about just the influence of working in a team and the kind of rigor and discipline that you get from sport. So it doesn't surprise me that it has translated into some of that career approach. I'd love to dig in a little bit into your approach to marketing, because you say you combine the art and science. I'd love to know what that means to you and if you have any kind of core beliefs maybe around how you approach marketing.
Gosh, that's a wonderful question. I'd say it's something that I've formed and developed over time. And for me, the art part of marketing is really that visual identity, how you're going to take your brand voice and how you show up creatively and visually to connect with your audience. But to do that well, you really have to understand your audience, and that's data, right? Like really understanding audience data, customer personas. And that's where I think the magic happens, when you really have an innate understanding of your markets and your targets and your personas, and you evolve that into or marry that with a creative program and a content marketing program and a social media marketing program that suggests or that informs your ability to translate the data into something that's going to connect with your audience. And so for me, that's where the art and the science are. If you don't really do the homework, if you don't go back to your core marketing training of SWOT analysis and understanding your customers, then going out and trying a bunch of random things with your various planks of marketing isn't going to work. And so I also think that in marketing, it's become highly technical, and that's positive. And I think that's it's very easy or much easier to maybe track ROI with some of the more technical elements of marketing. But I think what we're seeing through COVID is you had folks that made this quick shift into their digital storefronts, and then they took the gas off of the personal interactions with their customers. And now people are scrambling to rebalance that brand portfolio to their performance marketing portfolio. So in my mind, and it's probably true of a lot of things in life, balance is important. I think that branding is where you create that social contract with your customers. It makes them more likely to forgive you because you are going to make mistakes. You are going to have missteps. If your entire program is performance marketing, it's transactional. So people can go and have transactions anywhere they want, but if they have a personal belief in you and they interact with you as a person, which is what any new consumer wants to do, they think of the companies they interact with as personalities, you better have one. You better have one for them to interact with, or they're going to go find somebody else to do business with. It's just too easy to find similar products now. So that to me is kind of where the art and the science comes together, is really thinking about personal connection with the data. And, you know, we've been talking about big data since I was in graduate school a million years ago. It keeps evolving. Marketing is going to be different by the time we hang up from this call in 45 minutes. That's part of what keeps it so interesting, is it's incredibly dynamic. You can't really know everything about marketing all at once. So you just have to keep surrounding yourself with people that are in the various areas of marketing that are growing, AI, ML, even different areas of performance marketing. It's dynamic. It's interesting. It can also be very lonely. I think the marketing role can be very misunderstood. If you lined up 10 CEOs in a room, they would all have different KPIs for their head of marketing. And so you have to have quite a bit of intestinal fortitude to stick with it.
Really interesting. And also the personality point you make, how important then is this kind of social media persona? We see a lot of funny Twitter personalities emerge with certain brands, and that becomes a thing attached to that brand, perhaps. How important is that? And then I'm going to ask you something that wasn't on the script, but it's around the recent kind of Bud Light debacle, I suppose, in terms of handling of a message and maybe misreading consumers or their response. How often is that a reality in the marketing?
We could spend a whole session just on the Bud Lights conversation. So I will try to make my comments brief. But in terms of the first question, which was around understanding, I think you said audience, was that the question, or personality?
Yeah, the personality, especially around social media, Twitter handles, et cetera.
Yeah. So my perspective on social media is that social media it's a strategy like every other strategy in marketing. And if what you're doing in social media doesn't connect back to your core purpose and your core values, then it's just another random act of marketing. It's going to be very difficult to tell whether it's having any influence on the other areas of your marketing program. You're probably going to have a hard time understanding if what you're doing is connecting to your audience. So even if you're in social, you can have more playfulness and you can be bold. And I talk a lot about how safe spaces are interesting, whereas brave spaces can transform. So the neat thing about social is the cycles are shorter. So if you do have a misstep, people can move on. But I do think that whatever you do from a marketing perspective has to connect back to your overall program. Random acts of marketing, you'll hear me say this over and over again, they just don't accrue to enough impact to help tell the story of what you've done that year. If I think about the Bud Light controversy, I think that there are several things that I wish would have been handled differently. I think from what I can gather, and I want to be clear, I don't have any insight or an inside track into anybody at Anheuser-Busch, despite being from St. Louis. I have no insider knowledge of the situation. But I think that if a company is going to ask a marketing leader to update a brand and to take it from being a sort of a fratty, laddish company, and it's a brand that was declining, just so we're clear. So it was a brand that was in decline. And then the person goes out and does something bold, which I find it very difficult to believe that nobody in Anheuser-Busch didn't approve this program. And then to publicly throw that person under the bus by removing them from their seat. Let's just say, I think a lot of mistakes have been made. And I'm sure that if they had had my professor in disaster recovery and crisis communications and management at Kellogg, he would have advised them to make a lot of different decisions. I think because now you've got a situation that's really polarized. So you have your far right that's canceling Bud Light for the reasons that we've talked about, right? They feel like it's becoming something that is aligned with values that they don't hold, as if somehow being trans is a value instead of something that you feel like is a life or death issue, which again, that's a whole conversation we can have another day. And then on the other end of the spectrum, you have people that are angry that more isn't being done to hold Bud Light accountable. And so on both sides of the equation, they're losing customers, right? So even the folks on the other end of the conversation that are upset about the way Dylan was treated, they're not buying it either. So you have a bit of a perfect storm. And I think a lot of it has to do with the handling. I think when you have employees that go out and they do something bold and you don't back them or find a way to back them, everybody loses and the management team loses credibility in that process. And I really feel for the person that's going through this. It's actually just reading up on that person last night, and clearly a very talented marketer, clearly didn't come up with all of this on her own. I'm sure it went through rounds of review. And I think it's very simplistic to blame an outcome on one person. It's kind of like when a whole management team signs up for a strategy and then the marketer gets blamed. This feels very much like that. And I think it happens all too often.
Very interesting analysis. Clearly a lose-lose, which is not any outcome we would want. But I do think this will become fodder for case studies in business schools as well as Kellogg, hopefully. So there will be teachable moments here, or there will be lessons learned, and hopefully a strategy can be carved so we don't end up with this lose-lose scenario again. I'd love to move now to some of your director roles, because that was actually how I came across you, was in your role at Grindr. And would love to hear what you're bringing to these roles and what you think makes a good director or chair in your view.
Sure. So I would say I started as like an advisory capacity. And so these board advisory roles are really offering the CEO or the marketing team, in whatever capacity you've been engaged, perspective on maybe campaigns they're getting ready to run or strategies that they're thinking about or how to help amplify work that they're doing. I mean, so with Simon Data, I work with this wonderful CEO named Jason Davis. That's a lot of what we've talked about. It's not a consistent engagement typically. It's episodic. It's when they really need you to come in and help with certain things. And so that really works well when you have a very demanding full-time job. And there's a couple of other ones that I'm involved with. There's one in London, which is Clue, which is doing DEI, really trying to take the bias out of the recruiting process and get more people thinking about roles that they wouldn't apply for on their own by getting companies more focused on the actual job requirements needed. So I think that has the potential to really disrupt. And I think Joseph and the team are just doing incredible work there. Again, it's looking at marketing information. It's looking at their value prop. It's really advising them. And what's the best and clearest way to tell their story? So those are two examples. With Grindr, it was an opportunity to sit. I knew that they were contemplating going public because the board was engaged last May. It went public in through a SPAC in November. What was intriguing to me about that is while a public company role is more demanding in terms of time, it was an opportunity to take all the skills that I've learned over the last, dating myself, 25 plus years, and really apply that to something that directly impacts the community that I live in, which is the LGBT community. And so I don't know that it often enough comes together where something that you're personally committed to and passionate about aligns with board work. And so this was a really unique opportunity to do that. I had extensive conversations with the lead investors. Their commitment to having the appointed directors being LGBT was impressive. I think obviously it was a very competitive process. We were interviewing them as much as they interviewed us. And we came away from it really excited about the opportunity to work with those folks on how we take Grindr to the next level. And so I was brought in specifically for marketing expertise, as was another person on the board, Megan Stabler. So that's really where I focus a lot of my attention. I just spoke with somebody this morning on the product side, just thinking about like marketing opportunities. And so it's a really neat opportunity to take a lot of what I've learned and help take that brand to the next level because it serves a really important role in the community. And I think Grindr, you know, there's the dating app, which is the core of the business, but they also do an incredible amount of work in the gay community. And I think those are stories that I'd love to see us amplify a bit more as well. And when monkeypox broke out, they were the first to reach out and work with CDC to get information into the community and understanding how to navigate that. So I think the level of passion in the employee community there has really personally touched me and been overwhelming. People are there because they want to be at Grindr and they want to make a difference. And spoiler alert, not everybody that works at Grindr is gay or LGBT. And so the people that are there, they're likely either really fierce allies or part of the community. And that's a really special alchemy from a board perspective to get to work with people that reflect that, that reflect your values back to you. So that's been, it's the most interesting board meetings I've ever been in, and I've been in a lot of them. And they're really focused on how we do the best job that we can for the community and stay really focused on being a competitive company that delivers results and delivers returns. So it's a long answer.
No, it's so interesting. And I think also the fact that you're also providing resources, that's something we do on the 50 Faces Pride landing page as well. We don't just have our podcasts and our show notes, but we have resources embedded in that because you spoke about the concept of a safe space and a better to have a brave space. And clearly Grindr is going to be that safe / brave space for many of its users. So why not have the resources there too? It makes absolute sense. So they don't have to look elsewhere. So that I love that evolution. Just love to now move to discuss LGBT inclusion in the professional roles you've had, how you think that's improving, speaking about brave spaces, safe spaces. What would you say was your own experience with that? And maybe you can go back to your own experience coming out first. So we just hear a little bit about your journey.
Sure. Maybe I'll talk about professionally coming out, which was, because personally, it's a little bit of a different story, but professionally, say early in my career, particularly being in a more conservative area of wealth management, we had a lot of conversations, and maybe this will ring true a little bit for you as well, around tokenism. There was a lot of backlash against affirmative action. There was a feeling kind of in the ether that you really wanted to be recognized for your work first and foremost. I do think some of this was probably very passive aggressive and not helpful for those of us that were in communities that were, I don't want to say marginalized, but challenged. So I think that from a professional perspective, I had some advice from somebody who I dearly loved and valued who said, really just focus on the work. You're so talented. I don't want to see you get sidelined. And I do believe that person came from a place of deep love and protection and care. What made that hard is you get further into your career, you realize all of that holds you back, right? That like the less that you can be authentic and the less that you can do the work that you're really meant to do and the less that your voice starts to matter because people will feel it from you. They might not know what it is, but they'll feel it from you. So I got to a point where I'd moved to Seattle. I had left. I was working in St. Louis for a few years and then moved to Seattle. And I met a person who's now my wife and it just became too difficult to try to navigate it. It was too difficult. And the people weren't using non-gendered pronouns in the same way that they are today. So when I would do that, I think people were probably onto the scent long before I shared it. And so when I came out, it was challenging because I worked in a company where my mother was a consultant. And so if I came out, I felt like, oh man, she's going to have so many questions to answer and she's not going to want to answer them. And it's going to be really difficult. And then I got to a point where I said, I can't do this anymore. So I came out and it was because I was up for a job in Chicago that I had turned down 5 or 6 times. And this wonderful man who I love, I worked for him twice at Bank of America. He said, what is actually going on? It makes no sense that you are turning down this job. I'm not going to let you turn it down again. And I said, well, here's the thing. I have a partner and I'm a lesbian. He's like, okay, but they're included in Relo. Like he literally couldn't it was such a matter of fact conversation that I thought, maybe this is going to be okay. We did end up relocating. And before my first day, I go to have just a quick stop by the office. So I knew where I was going to be going on Monday. And the first question my future executive assistant asked me was, how does your husband like it here? And I just remember thinking, well, it's now or never. And I looked at her and said, I don't have a husband, but my wife loves it here. And so it wasn't as hard as I thought it would be, but there were definitely uncomfortable moments. And I think with coming out at work, particularly, you know, this was the early 2000s, late 90s is when I started working, early 2000s, it does get exhausting. And I don't want to gloss over that point. You literally feel like you're coming out all of the time. And it was acute when I had my son. We have a 12-year-old and a 6-year-old. I was in the office and pregnant, obviously. And I would just get asked wildly inappropriate questions. I mean, things that people just shouldn't be asking anybody really about their pregnancy journey. And I would get asked them, I think, because it was a curiosity and, you know, probably a little bit of sport as well. And so I don't want to pretend like those things weren't hard, but there was a meeting that I was in that made it clear to me that it was time for me to sort of stop navigating everybody else's comfort and prioritize mine. I was in a room of SVPs and somebody asked me a question. They said, how did you get pregnant? And it was much more crass than that. I'm making this a little bit nicer for your podcast. And so I looked at them and I said, essentially the idea was, did you bring a man home so that you could get pregnant, knowing full well that I was married, right, to a woman? And clearly, you know, maybe that wasn't the process. Maybe it is for somebody else, but either way, not an appropriate question to ask in a mixed audience. And I found myself looking back at the person very calmly and saying, I know more about the sperm that created this baby than your wife probably knows about yours. Next question. And it never came up again. And there were younger women in that room that I think needed to see somebody really stand up to somebody asking a question that was so out of bounds. So that moment, I think, really was the beginning of my advocacy journey. I'd love to tell you that from the moment I came out, I've been loud and I've had the volume on 10. That's not true. I really had to figure my own self out first. I had to figure out how I wanted to show up and where I wanted to show up before I decided I could be out there talking to the world about my journey. And so I'm glad I gave myself the time and space to go through that process because now you really can't shut me up. And I do think that everything that I've gone through makes me a better leader. I think that coming out process informs my empathy and informs my EQ. I'm able to see when somebody is struggling just from their body language. I'm able to see when somebody wants to say something but isn't speaking up. And so while all of that has been hard, I think the resilience that I've built through that process has made me a better leader, made me a better mother, a better partner, a better friend, while also being lonely and sometimes sad. And, you know, sometimes I was really hurting, but I'm grateful for the journey, if that makes any sense. And I wish that I had seen an out lesbian, and I never came across one that was out in the 13 years that I was at Bank of America. Definitely met more out people when I went into Aon and, you know, was in Chicago, but I didn't have that. And so my hope is that at least if people see it, they believe that they can become it. And so that drives me, that keeps me going, because there are days that are rough. When the Grindr board was announced, I got some pretty nasty messages and some pretty hateful notes. And you really have to have a lot of personal resolve for why you're doing what you're doing, because people are not going to like it. So you have to like what you're doing more than somebody can attack you for what you're doing.
Absolutely. And it sort of takes on a life of its own. It becomes bigger than you, I think, the mission. And that's like those podcasts are for me. It's bigger than me now. The stories are telling themselves.
That's right.
I would love to ask, though, I mean, about how things have improved or evolved. I mean, definitely the absence of role models is something we've heard here before. The fact that there is something called Lesbian Visibility Week, you know, is clearly there because visibility is an issue. There seem to be more gay men out than women, perhaps visible in the workplace, and why mm-hmm. that is. How have things improved, and what helps, do you think, promote inclusion?
Things have improved dramatically. I mean, full stop. I mean, I think there are conversations that we have in the workplace that we weren't having even 10 years ago. So I think to say that they aren't better, I think would be dismissive. I think where you're going to see people feel challenged is that there is a backlash right now that feels like we are losing ground. And I think folks have spent decades gaining that ground. And it does feel like because of this backlash from the far right, that those rights are being taken away. And not just for gay people, for women. You know, there's so many things that are happening that are moving us in a direction that I don't feel, and I don't think I'm alone in saying this, is the right direction for society, for women, for gay people. Name a challenged community. From a corporate perspective, what I think is that companies tend to be more progressive than politicians and government. And so I think that what has become something that companies were afraid to do, they're now being held accountable and expected to do, which is, what do you stand for? What are your values? How do you think about ESG? How do you think about culture? How do you demonstrate that culture? Do you demonstrate it from an investing perspective? Do you demonstrate it from an HR perspective? Is it recruiting? Are you inclusive? Have you eliminated unconscious bias? Are you setting up diverse candidate slates? I mean, you can go in so many different directions. These were conversations that weren't being had 20 years ago. And so from that perspective, I think it's been a powerful move in the right direction. I think that also brands have to be careful to make sure that that's a commitment they have year round, right? So if you show up and you slap a rainbow flag on it one time a year, then you set yourself up as a victim and nobody's going to feel very bad for you, right? Like Pride's all year long. Black History Month is all year long, right? I could name any other group, but I don't want to take away from the fact that I do think we've made tremendous progress. But I think the world right now is tenuous and a little bit scary. And I think it's also important to acknowledge that. And I think we need our companies to lead the way. And with COVID, there have been a lot of different pressures on companies. And it's been inspiring to see those that are keeping their investment in DEI despite the headwinds. It's been devastating to see those that really had those programs in place to tell a PR story and see them peeling back from that. Is that the first sign of trouble? And I think those are things that people are paying attention to. So we'll see how that shakes out.
And just the last question around inclusion is around LGBT parents. Do you find that you mentioned some of the questions you were asked during your pregnancy, which are totally inappropriate, and maybe just people trying to understand, and sometimes there may be clumsiness there and they may use the wrong terms, and sometimes it comes from the right place, it just comes out wrong. And I've also heard about children needing to come out themselves almost about their parents because those conversations aren't always easy. Do you think we've come far in that respect, or what do we still need to do to make that easier?
I think we have come far. I think we have come far in that respect. Listen, I'm a person who uses humor a lot to diffuse situations that could become uncomfortable. I do think that you come across folks that just haven't had the exposure and they're trying. I think you can, for me, I feel like I can tell when somebody's trying to do the right thing. And if somebody's trying to do the right thing and is also willing to be coached on how it didn't come across in the way they intended, you've just had an impact on that person that they're going to take out to five other people. If they say the wrong thing and you're just immediately offended and assume it's personal, then you've just shut down an education opportunity. So I am a big believer that if you have the intestinal fortitude, it's a word I use a lot, if you have the intestinal fortitude to do a little bit of education, then that pays dividends bigger than feeling bad in that one interaction. That does not work for everybody. So I am not suggesting that everybody's job is to educate the straight world on how to interact with the LGBT world. And I want to be really clear on that. But for me, I've found that that is a way that I feel like I can do good. And I probably just have a tougher skin after being out for so many years in the workplace. And, you know, I've worked in traditionally male-dominated professions. So being in conservative, patriarchal environments is not new for me. And so you do figure out your ways to cope. You figure out your ways to be authentic in your own way while not disengaging people. Because as a leader, your most important job is to bring people together to solve problems. If you can't find that connective tissue, you're going to struggle. So humor is an effective device, connection is an effective device, you know, having an EQ. So I think that there's a degree to which you've got to find your way through that in order that you don't become somebody that's just alienating and shut down. Because frankly, I think you get hurt a lot from that situation. You're hurt more frequently than the person that's asked the question that feels ignorant.
Absolutely. And I love that you're such a born communicator, that the communication and bridging and humor. I'm a huge believer in that. I mean, life is hard. We may as well laugh. We can laugh or cry, but certain instances, we may as well laugh most of the time.
Well, we have an advantage even. We're Irish.
Absolutely.
We're predisposed.
Absolutely. Just getting back to your personal story, a few reflections. Were there any particular setbacks or challenges over the course of your career that you learned lessons from?
Oh, gosh. I mean, many. I think that for me, some of the most powerful lessons I've learned in my career have come through failures. I wish that wasn't the case, but I think when you fail spectacularly, it informs how you approach everything going forward. I think that earlier in my career, when there were big mistakes made or big missteps made, I was so hard charging and ambitious that I wasn't always as understanding of those situations as I should have been. And particularly in banking, where it's so high stakes and you're dealing with such big dollars, that's not to excuse it, but it can be hard to find your way to empathy and compassion. As I've moved through my career, I found that those mistakes that I've made where I know I hurt people, and you leave those situations and you don't end up feeling very good about it either, right? Let's just be honest. When you lose your patience, it's a trigger. And then you come down from it, you're like, God, wow, why did I do that? And I think as I've had bigger stakes projects, it's allowed me to find the path through when something was a misstep. And we were doing a massive global brand launch for Alight. And it was a big secret. We did a global countdown. We were working around the clock in the basement of an agency in the West Loop. There were, I think, 9 of us that were there full time, and then a whole bunch of other people around the world keeping the lights on with every other marketing program. And we had the mailers to the work from home workers. They got the mailers before the brand launch, which was kind of devastating. We'd kept everything under wraps. And I think earlier in my career, I probably just would have had a meltdown. Let's be honest. Like, I just would have. And what ended up happening is I worked with the head of comms. We turned this into, hey, you guys are usually out of the loop. This time you're in the loop. Just keep this under wraps for a little while longer. And the team was just devastated. And the first impulse I had was, I was away from the dungeon where we were working on the brand for the evening. And I went down there with my wife and brought like a bottle of wine, and she brought a 6-pack of beer. And we're like, it's going to be okay. And that was exactly the right thing to do. I think getting frustrated when somebody knows they've made an error is the absolute worst thing you can do as a leader. It eliminates any trust that they ever had in you. And so I do think some of those mistakes and some of those missteps that I made earlier, and I mean, I could think of so many, those have helped me be better as the stakes got even bigger, because you have the muscle memory to know that being an ass in that situation served no one. It served no one. It didn't serve you. It didn't serve the person. It didn't move the project forward. It's how do you find the way through? And how do you support people through that process? And how do you make sure it doesn't happen again, but you just keep moving forward? And so mistakes inform, mistakes teach. And I think if you ignore the learning coming from a mistake, then you're just going to keep making them. And I think you do keep making mistakes until you learn the lesson. And so it's important to really look inward when those things happen.
Yeah, and marketing is often about framing. And I think framing, yeah. I've heard that framing, if you're not winning, you're learning, not losing. Like, yeah. Losing is the right. Only time you learn. So that, if you don't learn, then you're missing the opportunity to learn that comes from participating, I suppose, at all, from competing. Let's ask you about some of the key people, mentors or sponsors you've had in your career. And maybe if you could just repeat again how you see the difference between those two roles.
Sure. I would say that I've been fortunate. Many of the early sponsors, and I call them sponsors because they really took a personal interest in my career and in my development, they went on to really big roles. One runs 401k product development at T. Rowe. Another one ended up on the board of Bank of America. One is now the CEO of AMN Health. I have another one that's Fiduciary Trust International. And there are some stinkers in there. So, I don't want to take away from the fact that not every boss I've had has been wonderful. But my first few were so formative. And I think the principal difference between a mentor and a sponsor challenges you. A mentor listens and advises. But a sponsor is going to challenge you to think about, okay, what would you do differently? And mentors can do this too. And how would you do this if the opportunity presented itself the next time? And then sponsors are also looking for opportunities for you. So there are people that ask me for advice. There are people that I ask for advice. And there are people that I ask to open doors for me. And I think that that's, to my mind, and the way I think about mentors and sponsors, I've been fortunate to have some really strong mentors who were just so knowledgeable about what they do and how they do it. But I also had this stable of people that were sponsors that I always say, if you're going to go through a door and you're not reaching your hand back and pulling people through with you, that you've missed a golden opportunity to make your company better, the world better, what have you. All of the examples I had early in my career were people doing that. I worked for a woman named Laura Whitley who made really bold hires before maybe the company was ready for some of those hires to take place. I worked for Paul Cummings, who has had an incredible career, and he would just throw so much stuff at me and just trusted me to get it done. And if I asked him a question, he made himself available right away. And then he would let me keep going because he knew that what I needed was latitude and runway. And so a mentor can advise you on specific situations. A sponsor really understands the totality of your skill set, and they're going to throw things at you that they know will stretch you, but that they believe you can complete it, and that they're also going to always be scouting for opportunities for you to grow. Those distinctions might feel small, but they're the difference between a career that continues to push you and a career where you flatline and you kind of plateau for a while. I had a guy that used to work for, Marcus Noguez, and he shared advice with me when I got my first big CMO job. And he said, shared something with me that his dad shared with him, which was, if your next job doesn't scare you, you aren't dreaming big enough. And that has stuck with me. I mean, it was probably 15 years ago, and that has stuck with me my entire career. And it was invaluable advice. Sponsors help you do that. Sponsors help you believe in yourself before you're ready. And it's such a special relationship. And if you find it, you hold on to it.
And it's interesting because I love that drive to always challenge and learn, but equally that can be tiring at times as well. I mean, you have to pace yourself for that journey to make sure you can still have the energy to do it, because it can be a challenge.
I think piece of it too, I didn't touch on this, but I think the other piece, the really rewarding relationships are when there's a reverse sponsorship and mentoring happening as well. I think that when you are working with somebody who values your perspective, but you're also willing to learn from them. I mean, I've got people in that camp as well, and it makes me a better leader. When I'm working with somebody that's maybe a few spaces away from where I am in my career, or maybe, you know, a decade or two behind where I am in my career, it informs me too, and it helps me become a better leader. So I think more and more you're going to see these relationships become bidirectional. And I think that makes a huge difference on the impact in both your life and theirs.
Yeah, I love that. I was going to ask you about the reciprocity. And I think pulling that person through the door with you is really the key to passing it on, lifting others up, and it not being one-sided. The last question is around any creed or motto that you have, or any piece of advice, whether from some of these mentors and sponsors, or advice that you'd give to your younger self. Anything you can leave us with there?
Yeah, gosh, that's a great question. I should really have like a very ready answer for that. I think for me, if I think about marketing and leadership as a craft, I think that there's one tenet that applies to both and that matters. Help people that don't feel seen to feel seen. I think if that's what you're doing, and I think marketers sit in such a unique position to do that societally and at large. And if you squander that opportunity, then maybe go do something else, because I do think marketers can help the world become more inclusive. They can help the world become more equitable, and they can get more diverse voices into the conversation. And I think the same principle holds true for leadership. I think the other thing that I would say to my younger self, take the work seriously, but don't take yourself so seriously. I think that the more that I've lightened up, the better I've become at my job. And I think, what's the phrase? You're burning in your 20s, you're learning in your 30s, and you're earning in your 40s and beyond. I 100% fall into those tranches. And I wish I'd have taken a little more time to just take a deep breath and enjoy the journey versus always looking at, okay, what's next? What am I going to do next? What's the next step? And so I think that's another piece. And I say it a lot, but I wish my younger self could have heard that. You don't have to take yourself so seriously, and you can still be really effective and competitive and win.
Well, thank you so much, Maggie. It has been such a rich conversation. You speak about creating those brave spaces and making people feel seen. And I'll say that we notice when we are made feel seen, whether that's any member of any underrepresented group or a member of the LGBTQIA community, it is noticed. I think marketers don't always get the feedback perhaps that you want. You look at metrics, but do you know how you've touched lives? Not always, but I can say from my perspective, we do notice. So thank you so much for coming here and sharing your insights with us.
Thank you for having me.
I'm Ethan Devitt. Thank you for listening to our 50 Faces Focus series. If you liked what you heard and would like to tune in to hear from more inspiring professionals and their stories, please subscribe on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts.
This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be construed as investment advice, and all views are personal and should not be attributed to the organizations and affiliations of the host or any guest.